Glad you're here with us on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you and your wallet. I want you to learn ideas from me so you can save more and spend less and don't let anyone ever rip you off. And you can follow me at facebook.com/Clark Howard. Coming up in just a few minutes in today's Clarkrageous Moment, I want to bring you up to date on the newest version of identity theft, how it could really confound you, the banks, the credit bureaus, and what you need to know, the mystery that could affect you with your credit. And coming up yet later, new news for you about student loan forgiveness. I'm going to fill you in on some new developments that require that you act quickly to take advantage of them. So, a lot of buzz in the financial community, not much otherwise, about Walmart being rumored to either be going into a joint venture with Humana or potentially even buying Humana. There's a big urge to merge across healthcare and across retail with big pharmacy operations, the mergers that have been going on with the drugstore chains, the pharmacy benefits managers, and something that is not really considered or talked about is Walmart employs a zillion people, the largest non-governmental employer in the United States, and they employ, depending on how you measure it, 1.5 million to a little over 2 million people. And so Walmart is a ginormous payer of healthcare bills to its own people. And they've been trying in many creative ways to get the costs under control and at the same time improve the quality of care their employees receive. In addition, Walmart's pharmacy counters write a giant boatload of prescriptions each year. And so Walmart, in some ways, is really already in the medical field. And in this jockeying of big players trying to figure out, in Walmart's case, how to reduce their own costs, and on the other hand, provide better services in the healthcare arena to its own employees, there's stuff coming, because the way we're doing healthcare in the United States obviously doesn't work. It's going to require a lot of innovation, creativity, and experimentation. And I know there are people who just despise Walmart. I particularly look forward to seeing what Walmart is able to do with a joint venture or a totally owned operation of Humana, because the access, availability, affordability of healthcare is a big problem in the United States. And there's a dividing line. As a general rule, the top 20% of income earners in the United States have pretty good access to what's known as continuity of care, to health care, are overwhelmingly insured through a place of work, and don't face the instability that most Americans face with access to health care and also stable insurance coverage. So good luck, Walmart. Hope you're able to figure things out that will benefit all of us as we do something about the healthcare cost equation in the United States that is more than double the equivalent cost per person in any other developed country. Drea joins us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Drea. How are you?
Hi, Clark. I'm good. How are you?
Good. So you are a fellow lover of travel.
I am. I love it. I want to make it full time.
What's your favorite place in the world?
Well, my family goes up to Duluth, Wisconsin every year, and that's just like, I guess I'm sort of biased towards that, but I want to go everywhere, so.
Well, going everywhere is something that I have failed to accomplish. Do you know the two places on Earth I've not been yet?
How many?
So I've not been in the United States. I've not been to North Dakota. And of the world's continents, I've not been to Antarctica.
Okay, well, you got like 6 out of 7, so that's pretty good.
I'm getting there. Do you know why I won't go to Antarctica?
Why? Because it's cold?
No, because I'm a wimp. I can't deal with the waves. You know, when you when you leave southern South America on your way down to Antarctica, the waves are 40 to 60 feet high.
Oh, my gosh.
And that sounds like no fun at all. But the funny thing is, if you get through it in reasonable shape and you get down to Antarctica, you still get to look forward to going through the 40 to 60 foot waves
coming back
South America. So
that sounds terrible.
Yeah, that's not for me. Well, as a fellow travel lover, how can I be of service to you?
So, like I said, I want to make travel full time. And one of the opportunities that I was looking into was starting a blog because I'm a gifted writer and I'm interested in sharing stuff like that and like finding my niche and starting to build off that. So I did a lot of research and I found an online online class that guides you through the whole experience of building a blog, how to build it, and then going into running it successfully, generating revenue, and, starting to partner with brands and stuff as you're traveling.
And how much is it?
Writing on these things. I'm sorry.
How much is it?
It's around $300, so that's why I'm hesitant. I don't want to, just throw my money away.
Yeah, I mean, the course you may be looking at may be perfectly legitimate, may be great, but that is too much money. I mean, I'm pulling up right now on Udemy. Have you ever heard of Udemy?
I have not.
Udemy.com, which offers a zillion different online courses, and the prices on the courses change continually, but I'm looking right now, and there's one... how to start a travel blog. That's specifically what you're asking about, right?
Correct. Yeah.
It's $11.99.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay.
And it goes through all the steps involved in, getting your own domain name, how to build your blog using off-the-shelf stuff like WordPress, and then how to successfully find audience and target that audience with the information they're looking for.
Okay.
And, my attitude is start with the $11 course. And if you don't like it or you feel like it's not really speaking to you, you've lost $11.
Right.
But Udemy also has a wide variety of courses on blogging in general that are very good that go through blogging. And with travel, you need to think with another letter starting it, a V for victory, because so much of the travel stuff now is a combination blog and vlog.
Yeah.
Because people want to see the pictures, they want to see short video clips, and you need to become like somebody who's like, hey, Drea's really the go-to person for blah, blah, blah type of travel. And you want them to identify with you, and they need to see you, and you show them what it is you're interested in. So I hope that you have a great career in this, because I'm so into people being out there spreading the good word about how valuable for our lives travel is. You know, what we really treasure over time are experiences, not things. And travel is one of my all-time favorite things that I ever do, and you're getting right in the middle of it. Jeannie joins us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Jeannie.
Hi there. Hi, Clark.
Jeannie, now you want to talk about something with travel that's not good at all.
That's right.
What happened?
It was a bummer. I love to go to New York City. I love it. And I had not been in several years, and I had a chance to meet a friend up there. And I set up an Airbnb in Harlem that was a really good price. And I knew exactly how to get from JFK to, you know, to that place. Everything was cool. But then I was in the security check-in line at the airport when I got a call from Airbnb customer service that my host had canceled.
Canceled and on the day of arrival?
Yeah.
Wait. I've heard of Airbnb hosts canceling like a few days out, week out.
Right.
On somebody day of, they better have had a good excuse, like the building just burned down or something.
I know. Somebody had to have died, you know, but there was no excuse. There was no excuse given. And, you know, I had been texting with him just a couple hours earlier about picking up the key. I mean, everything was fine. And so I was like shocked. I was just stunned and I had no idea what to do. And I still had to get to my gate on the D concourse, you know. I mean, I was just, and the Airbnb lady was trying to be really helpful. She sent me links to alternate, you know, places that were close by. And, you know, all this I'm doing on my phone while I'm trying to go through security with the bins and everything.
So did you go ahead and go to New York or did you bail the trip right then?
You know, I had to bail.
Oh,
I contacted two alternates, but they both turned me down because it was last minute and they weren't prepared. And the plane was loading. And I had, you know.
What did Airbnb do for you in that situation?
You know, they were great. The customer service was awesome. I have to say, she was just wonderful. She got me, you know, full refund with 20% over that, and she paid. They paid the cancellation fee that the airline was going to charge me.
So well, really I thought you were going to start telling me this nightmare how Airbnb not only canceled on you but said, "Ah, well." So they stepped up
No, it was nothing like that. They really were great.
Wow.
But honestly, I felt like their policy needs to change. That's why I contacted you.
What policy?
Well, the host can cancel at any point. I could have arrived at this guy's doorstep.
So actually, the way Airbnb system works is that there is clear punishment of somebody who does a cancel on somebody.
Right.
You may not notice it, but behind the scenes, they make it really clear to Airbnb hosts what the consequences are. And you were allowed to post a guest review that is public. Have you done that yet?
Yes, I did.
All right. And if you go look at the listing, you'll see it's right there for anybody to see.
Yeah.
And then what Airbnb does is they put the person kind of on probation.
Okay.
And they also will keep that individual from being able to make it into their elite club. What's it called? It's like super host or something that is really important to generating revenue from an Airbnb listing. So they do have consequences for that individual, but Airbnb doesn't own the places. So they have no way to compel that individual to perform.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like a collective wisdom thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a great thing for you, not their fault that somebody using Airbnb as a host did this to you and dissed you so badly. But they refunded your money, no question, and gave you 20% money and covered your change fee, even though you were so inconvenienced. That was not Airbnb's doing, and that host will suffer. So I think that's the best we can hope for. And have you,
you know,
rebooked to New York yet?
Pay attention to the reviews, because somebody else had said that he had canceled on them too. I don't know that it was such a last minute deal.
Have you rebooked to New York yet, Jeannie?
Oh, no, not yet.
Oh, please, rebook that trip. I heard such anticipation in your voice, such excitement about going. Please, you got the Airbnb money to use? Go. Enjoy it. Today's Clark Regis moment is a special heads up for you. There is a very odd, obscure method of identity theft that I just want on your radar. It's where someone uses your Social Security number that they know is a good number with somebody else's name and what often is referred to as John Doe, Jane Doe identity theft. They are then buying things as if they are somebody else's name, but your number. It takes longer for the system to catch up, and it becomes very confusing to people who are victims of identity theft, where you're getting called and they're asking for somebody else's name at your number. And then they're saying you get a number of calls for this other name. That's likely what's going on. And I just want you to know that this is one of the wrinkles with identity theft that people are having to deal with. And if you do start getting strange calls from a collector, what sounds like a bill collector, for somebody else's name at your number, I want you to immediately get copies of your credit report and see if any weird charges, new accounts, are posting to your credit. And that is likely what connects the mystery about why you're getting calls to your number about another named individual. You have some same kind of things to deal with identity theft and cleaning it up, but it's a little more work when somebody uses a different name but your number. Glad you're with us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to keep more of what you make. I need to give you good news if you are a former student who is attempting to get student loan forgiveness. As you've heard many callers over the years, as you've heard me talk about, there are all kinds of administrative problems with the federal student loan forgiveness program. There are two basic types. One is student loan forgiveness for those who work in public service jobs, police officer, firefighter, teacher, nonprofit, who get loan forgiveness after 10 years of on-time payments. And then for non-public service workers, there generally are programs that will potentially forgive loans after payments of 20 years or more. Well, the problem is people who've been paying in good faith, thinking they were clicking off years in the forgiveness program, have ended up being cheated by their federal loan servicer. The loan servicers don't have incentives to treat people right. In fact, they have incentives to cheat people. And that's exactly how the industry has behaved. So the Congress just passed legislation that will allow people who have done what they were supposed to do, but didn't necessarily check off every clerical mark, to have their years of payments count towards the loan forgiveness. In addition, Congress put money in the budget specifically for loan forgiveness, but they only put so much money. And so what it means is that if you were someone who in good faith has been doing what you were supposed to do to pay on your student loans, you were in the cycle that you thought would lead to the remainder of your student loans being forgiven, then you were notified, nope, you got nothing, that you now have hope on two points. One, that your years will count, and two, that the Congress allocated some money to actually fund the forgiveness. As far as the money, it is first come, first serve, which means that some people, at least at this point, still will not get money for loan forgiveness because, well, there's not going to be enough money to pay for everybody. So there are specific procedures that explain this at Clark.com. What are the things you need to do to get those prior years of payments counted towards your loan forgiveness, and what other steps you need to take? So basically, this is, for lack of a better term, it's an amnesty period for you for the dishonesty and or incompetence of the federal student loan processors. So you're able to get your years reinstated or instated, whatever we'd call it, and not be punished for crooked lenders and incompetence. So again, go to Clark.com. We'll walk you through what you need to do. Make sure that any family member who is in a public service job who you think or know borrowed under the federal student loan program knows that they've got to make sure they're doing everything 100% exactly right to qualify for the forgiveness. Keith is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Keith.
Hi, Clark. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Keith. You have a question for me about Charles Schwab.
Yeah. So I know a couple months ago you had spoken about certain money managers making bonuses off of putting people in certain investments, and I do all of my investing and IRAs with them, and I just don't know how I know if I'm in any of those funds and if my money manager is really acting as a fiduciary for me.
So that's a great question. The person who's representing you, are they a Schwab employee or are they an outside firm?
They are a Schwab employee.
So you can ask your money manager directly, are you a fiduciary? And they have to tell you. If you don't ask the question, they don't have to disclose it.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you asked the question?
I haven't. I guess it's kind of one of those uncomfortable questions to ask, like, hey, are you really doing the right thing?
No, you just, this is how I'd ask. I'd say, I'm really confused. This guy who is on the radio loves Charles Schwab and was very upset recently about Schwab, and these are the things that he was upset about. So it's not like you're saying, you're just saying, hey, I'm confused here because this guy, Clark Howard, saying this stuff about you, and even though he loves Schwab, he's upset. So what's the story? And so that immediately puts the frame where you're not asking the uncomfortable questions. I'm the one that's the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then say, are you a fiduciary? And person has to answer that.
Yeah.
And if they're not, then you need to ask, well, how do I know that the things you're putting me in aren't what Clark's talking about, that you were putting me in things that were bad for me that cost me more money so you could make more?
Yeah.
So just make it all about me being the bad guy saying things about them, and all you're doing is asking to be reassured.
Yeah, there's just no transparency online of how much anything costs, so it's so hard to know how much.
What kind of things have you invested in at Schwab?
I mean, that's the thing. So, like, they do all they manage it all for me. So looking at all the investments they have me in, there's ETFs and various, you know, mutual funds that they have me in.
So ETFs, by their very nature, cost basically nothing.
Okay.
So ETFs are, for anybody listening who doesn't know what we're talking about, Keith, exchange-traded funds. They're kind of like a mutual fund that trades like a stock, is the simplest and most inaccurate explanation I can give, but they carry extremely low costs. And mutual funds, are they Schwab's own or are they other companies' mutual funds?
They're other companies.
So you can, you should be able to ask your representative, what are the management fees on this? And then another question you ask, are there any 12B1 charges? You don't want to be in any funds that have 12B1s.
Okay.
And you'll know when you bring this topic up, you'll be able to tell if your Schwab representative is being evasive or direct with you. And you'll also have made it very clear to your representative that you're watching and you only want to be in the lowest cost investment choices that are available.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
All right. And I'd love follow-up from you, Keith, if the conversation kind of goes off the rails with you and your rep.
Okay.
Have a great day. Mike is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Clark. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Mike. I love what you're about to delve into here. Hit me with your question, if you would.
Okay, so I just got a new job, and they let me drive the company car for personal use now, and I don't really have much of a use for my old car, so I decided I'm going to get rid of it. And talking to my insurance agent, they suggested I carry a non-owner vehicle coverage.
One of the most overlooked policies there is out there, and one that I believe in very much. So your agent is giving you what I believe to be good advice. And this is going to become a huge issue over the next several years because so many people are choosing not to own a car anymore. And they're using Zipcars or equivalents, or they're using Turo or any of a number of things where they're using other people's vehicles on temporary cycles. And so in your case, you're only going to have the company vehicle, which means, do you know why? I'm curious, how did the agent explain why it would be good for you to have the non-owner's policy?
I think the first point, this was a couple of months ago I had the conversation, but I think the first point he made, and the biggest one, was to maintain or to prevent having a gap in coverage if I were to buy a car again. And then also, if I were to rent a vehicle, it would be covered. And there was
liability with a typical non-owner's policy. I guess it's possible one would cover collision and comprehensive with a rental car. I shouldn't say they wouldn't, but more often than not, it's really about the liability side of things.
Okay.
The first thing you mentioned, not having a break in auto insurance coverage, I would say that would be a lower priority. I'm really much more concerned about the liability side. Because if you're in a wreck in the company vehicle and you're at fault and the company has so much coverage, beyond that, you're still potentially at risk. And that's why there's such an advantage with the non-owner.
Okay.
And with these other situations that are different than yours, where somebody just gets a car occasionally and goes without owning one, the same issue applies that if you had an accident that was an expensive one, you know, somebody gets badly hurt and they're going to need care for a lengthy period of time or the rest of their lives, the liability exposure is so large that I really like it. Now, one other thing I would ask the agent about if you do decide to buy a non-owner policy is, can you buy uninsured motorist coverage as part of it? Because one of the risks you face is that you're in an accident with somebody else whose fault it is, and they either don't have insurance or they have minimal, and you don't have enough coverage through your employer potentially for your medical costs.
All right, I'll do that.
So those are two aspects I'm most interested in, is liability and the uninsured motorist.
Great. I appreciate that. I was really curious about what this was all about because I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah, I have a brother who goes cycles without owning a car, and so he deals with those cycles with the non-owner policy. It is something that a lot of people who have younger siblings or adult children who don't own cars, it's something you should encourage them to do, to own, and it's something that is not going to be on people's radar. Billy is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Billy. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Clark. How are you?
Great, thank you. How can I serve you today?
Well, you can serve me by answering a question for me.
That'll be $20.
All right. Check's in the mail. My wife and I are on disability pensions and Social Security income. We have one credit card. We have one car payment, and the house is paid off. And our investments are half in annuity and half in market funds. My question is this. In the recent months, my wife has gotten more ill, and I'm going to be taking over the bill paying.
Well, I'm really sorry your wife's not doing as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My question is, I'd kind of like to get our bill paying onto maybe a cashback credit card where our monthly regular bills that roll over every month, gas and electric and what have you, which run about $1,200 to $1,500 a month, give or take, we would just put on a credit card and then pay the credit card off in order to get the cash back.
Yeah, it'll depend on the bill whether they permit you to pay by credit card fee-free.
Uh-huh.
Some of the utility companies make you pay either a couple of dollars or even as much as 2% using a credit card. But the ones that allow you to use a card fee-free, it's a great idea to use a cashback card.
And what cashback card do you think is one of the better cards out there that might be available?
There are actually two that are my favorite.
Uh-huh.
One of them is from Citibank. It's the Citi Double Cash Card, and it pays you 2%, but they do it in a really funky way. They pay you 1% at the time you do the charge and another percent when you pay the bill.
Oh, okay.
But it's 2%. I don't know who in their marketing department thought it was smart to make it so weird. But anyway, it's 2% just straight up everything you ever charge to it.
Right.
And if you have any investment accounts, retirement accounts, brokerage account, anything with Fidelity Investments, do you have anything with them?
Not with Fidelity, no.
Okay. Just for other people, let me mention Fidelity has a 2% cashback card that the money can go into an investment account, retirement account, or college savings plan.
We might have a Fidelity. Tammy, my wife says we do have a Fidelity.
Well, Tammy knows all, right?
Well, yeah, she does.
Okay. So then doing the Fidelity card might work really well for you because you're already in their system.
Okay.
And so 2% that's really much higher than effectively what most reward cards pay.
Okay.
Because most of them are paying 1.25% to 1.5%.
Right.
And you get up to 2%, you're in pretty rarefied air.
Okay. And then are these cards that you pay an annual fee?
No.
Okay.
No, you know, it's ironic. The only cards that tend to have annual fees are airline miles cards.
Yeah.
Nothing else in the credit card universe pretty much has annual fees except cards for people with challenged credit.
Okay. Our previous card we were just using at will. We didn't really use it at all for bills. We wrote checks, but it was for everything else. And we still have to pay down a little a HELOC that we got to do some home renovations. But when we start, then we'll look into this Fidelity card. But what we were using was a card that just gave you points and we would use it towards gift cards at Christmas time.
Well, I much prefer cash because the points, at some point, they could devalue the points and say this only gets you this much or that much. Getting 2% cash back, you know that's your cash. You're listening to The Clark Howard Show. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast of our show, I'd love it if you'd subscribe. Whatever your favorite podcast app is, we're pretty much there. And whether you love what you hear from me or hate it, take time to write a review. It's how we all learn from each other, is from those reviews.